What do you do when medications don't work? Do you keep hope alive or do you take a different direction? Welcome to the Carlite Psychiatry Podcast, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor-in-chief of the Carlite Psychiatry Report.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a psych NP and a dedicated reader of every issue.
Joe Goldberg is one of the psychopharmacologists that patients turn to when nothing else works. So when he published a paper in the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry 2 years ago with the title, When Further Medication Trials Seem Futile, it caught my eye. In it, he makes the point that we do a disservice to patients by continually dangling the carrot, promising a pharmacologic cure that's just around the corner, when in reality, our medications are not powerful enough to bring everyone to remission. Here are some lines from that paper.
There is an omnipresent, often tacit guiding principle within psychopharmacology to treat psychiatric disorders to the point of full remission. Comparatively less has been written about adopting an entirely different approach designed to manage, rather than reverse or eliminate, difficult and persistent psychiatric symptoms that respond poorly to multiple appropriate interventions. In such a model, once true drug pan-refractoriness is identified, treatment orientations shift from disease modification to chronic disease management. Unrealistic expectations about robust recovery are tempered, and coping becomes a primary rather than secondary focus. In this approach, our efforts aim to help patients accept and live with chronic symptoms as best as they can, akin to the modified goals of treatment when caring for patients with widely metastatic cancer, chronic pain, or permanent disabilities resulting from strokes or spinal cord transections. At first glance, such an approach may seem defeatist, and at variance with the concept of striving always to instill a sense of hope in patients and their families. However, it becomes disingenuous to encourage overly optimistic expectations when the chances of greater success from further psychotropic drug trials are, beyond a certain point, minimal.
What Joe is talking about here is something many of us see every day. Patients who haven't responded to any medication. I was trained to keep hope alive for patients, especially those with depression where hopelessness is part and parcel of the illness. Do we really cause harm, though, by keeping hope alive? Well, possibly, but wouldn't taking hope away be even more dangerous? In our online interview, Joe goes into detail on how he walks this high wire. I won't give away the answer, but I'll give a hint. Joe doesn't take hope away. He just moves it out of the medication room and into another.
I can think of one way that too much hope can backfire. One is with patients who have chronic depression. Sometimes if I'm too positive, the patient feels invalidated and they lose trust in me. This doesn't happen as much with acute depression. Those patients can usually still remember when things were better and they're able to believe that it can be that way again. But when a patient says they've been depressed since the day they were born and you say, "Don't worry, I've got something that will take that all away in 4 weeks," they just feel like you don't get them.
And when we say that recovery is just around the corner, it discourages them from doing what they need to adjust. Last month, we ran a podcast called What Locked-In Syndrome Teaches Us About Happiness. It was about how people persevere in the face of debilitating medical illnesses. One of the studies in that podcast really speaks to Joe's point. They took patients who were getting a colostomy, which is pretty difficult to live with. Half were told it would likely be permanent, and the other half were told the colostomy bag would probably come off in about 6 months. Then, they followed up 5 months later, just before the 6-month deadline. And who do you think were happier?
The ones who thought the colostomy was permanent.
Right.
Well, Dr. Aiken, I did make the podcast with you. But I also worked as a nurse on a dialysis unit, so I've seen that psychology. When people think the problem is going to go away, they don't adjust to it. When they think it's something they'll have to live with long term, they learn how to live with it.
So that begs the question, can you learn how to live with depression?
Right. I mean, I understand that adversity can build resilience, but depression is kind of defined as a lack of resilience. And anyway, if a patient learned to live with depression and wasn't bothered by it anymore, then would they still be depressed?
We'll have to turn to Joe Goldberg on that one. In our online interview, he gives details on how he works with patients who haven't found answers in medications. Today, we're just going to play the opening part of the interview, where Joe talks about the medication strategies he uses as a last resort before considering these highly resistant cases unresponsive to meds. Joe, you wrote that at some point further medication trials are futile in psychiatry.
The futile part of this, I don't think, is about can we treat patients. I think it's that our technology lends itself to a certain futility. But the real challenge with this whole notion, in my mind, is how do you not equate pharmacological futility with hopelessness? That is, how do you maintain some sense of we'll get you through this? It's just, it's not going to be with pills. And if it is going to be with pills, they're going to be a very small subsidiary part of your overall treatment. Psychiatry somehow bizarrely imagines itself as different from the rest of medicine. And the word futile comes up in every other area of medicine that I can think of. Many of the ailments that we treat are chronic and persistent and inexorable or progressive. It's almost a bit of hubris and arrogance to think that we can defeat any and all things. I mean, who else in medicine has that? Aside from the fact that our treatments are not that great, and one of my favorite chapters in the book that's coming out reviews all the effect sizes I could find of everything. Be amazed. Our effect sizes suck. I mean, Buspar's got an effect size of 0.15. Most of the SSRIs are around 0.2, 0.3.
Jeez, yeah.
So, and then there's biases because little studies have big effects. Like tamoxifen's got a huge effect in mania, but that was a small study. Ketamine's got a pretty respectable effect. Amphetamine's got a pretty respectable effect. Everything else is way less than 0.8. So we're working with a repertoire of medicines that, on the whole, are far less potent than, say, picture anesthesia. No anesthesiologist ever goes up to the patient and says, you know, we've got about a 4 in 10 chance you're going to go to sleep when I put this mask on your face. And yet we sometimes act as if we have that same level of surety.
So when is enough enough?
At what point do you say that my goals and objectives are less around disease transformation and more around disease management? And in my mind, that's actually more of a black and white line than some people imagine. STAR-D, I think, was a step toward that in saying, basically, you got two cracks at this before you start to have to worry. Mauricio Fava's group published an obscure paper that did some simulations at MGH. You know, you got certain point levels for pharmacology trials or for ECT. This is all in unipolar depression. And the takeaway was that after you hit a score of 5 or worse, the probability of remission was 0. Not low, 0. So that's what I mean when I say a stark line. You know, with every successive non-response, the probability goes down. And once you start to get around 5, it's pretty low.
So after 5 antidepressant trials, the chance of recovery is very low. But what about ECT?
In my dialogue with other people, even ECT and ketamine people, Charlie Kellner's a friend of mine. He just retired. He's done 40,000 ECTs. And we were once chatting, and I was saying, you know, what do you do with people that have had, you know, a dozen non-responses to things? And he says, you can certainly try ECT, but you'd be a real charlatan if you said to them, this is going to fix you. Because the odds are overwhelmingly against it. So it's a heroic maneuver. It may be worth a try, but you've got to set the bar really low. Expectations. You want to underpromise and overdeliver if you're lucky. But you got to make it clear to somebody that, you know, we have to be realistic. And part of what I do as a psychiatrist is reality test people. So if you've been sick for a long time, you've had many adequate trials, and you know, no unrecognized ailment has been missed. Oops, I didn't notice your heroin abuse, or gosh, you have Lyme disease, or just noticed your bulging thyroid, or something like that. Then I think it's an honest appraisal, and the probability that we're going to convert this from pathology to normalcy is low.
But don't we have treatments that work in treatment-resistant depression?
Most of the literature that I'm aware of in TRD enrolls subjects who've had between 2 and 5 non-responses in the current episode. That's the way the Spravato studies were done, the way the Symbiax studies were done. I believe that's the way the TMS studies were done. And I would imagine people like you and I see people who've had far more than 5 non-responses in the current episode.
Do we have any research on people who have failed five or more antidepressants?
The only drug that I know of that has been systematically studied in people over five trials is Pentexol. It was Jan Fawcett's American Journal paper. The mean number of failed trials in the current episode was five.
I remember that study. It was open label, right?
It was open label.
Yeah, I sure wish they had controlled that study because the results were impressive. Let me look it up here. It was a case series of 42 patients with bipolar or unipolar depression who had failed at least four medication trials. So you're right, up to five. And the average was six failed trials. Now, this is what struck me. 20% of them had failed ECT. So this is a very resistant population. They used pramipexole, and it looks like they went a little higher on the dose than usual. They averaged 2.5 milligrams per day instead of the usual 1.5 milligrams a day. And you're right, Joe. Here's what's remarkable. Half of the patients remitted, and another third responded. So pramipexole made a difference for 80% of these patients. It's pretty rare to see numbers like that. Joe, you actually introduced me to pramipexole 15 years ago when you published one of the first controlled trials on it. And since then, I've used it in over 900 patients, and I have seen it work when nothing else has, even when ECT has failed. And that makes sense that it would treat depression. This drug is a pure dopamine D3 agonist, so it goes right to the part of the brain that's involved in motivation, drive, reward, and pleasure, the nucleus accumbens. So I've always wondered, why did the manufacturer settle for Parkinson's disease and restless leg syndrome? Why didn't they seek approval in depression?
So after our study came out in 2004 and Zoradiv came out, Pfizer sold the drug to Boehringer Ingelheim. And they had contacted both me and Carlos about having a meeting to discuss two things. One, whether it was worthwhile to pursue PRAM for depression based on, we were very contemporary in our studies. But the other, which unfortunately torpedoed it, was there was no way to reformulate the molecule to extend the patent life. And the patent died within a year of those studies coming out. You know, the neuroanalysis came out, and then Chris Cousins and a few others, the studies came out, and then Jan Fawcett. I don't really believe in miraculous things, but I have a chapter in the book of Stahl just saying, you know, of the things that are known to work when many things have not, there's ECT, there's ketamine, there's PRAM, and then there's heroic MAOs, and that's really it.
Did you leave out augmentation with lithium or thyroid?
Yeah, I think they're okay. I make a face about lithium and thyroid because I think those drugs are okay. They certainly belong on the list of things, but I'm very skeptical that someone who's truly very, very refractory is going to have great success with either lithium or thyroid, or for that matter, even things like lithium and nortriptyline.
What is a heroic MAOI?
Yeah, parnate over 60, more like over 90.
I see. I thought when you said heroic MAOI that you meant an MAOI with a stimulant, which I've often heard is a dangerous but last resort measure for treatment-resistant depression.
Oh, that's even more heroic. There is a study where they talked about getting really aggressive and heroic. So that would be like parnate 120 with amphetamine, and you know, this is an open case series. No IRB is gonna approve that. And, you know, they reported, you know, no cardiovascular adverse effects. God knows how they managed it. Maybe some slight tachycardia, but nothing ischemic, no EKG changes. First, they took your parnate from 90 to 120, then they added Adderall. I think a few patients had lithium thrown in. And these are just cases to show what do you do when absolutely nothing else works, including ECT non-responders. But back to what's been studied with denominators in highly refractory patients, there's not a lot. So to your first question, when you say enough is enough, I mean, the way I position this to people is I'd say psychopharmacology certainly should and can and will continue to have relevance. New things are coming along all the time. Let's make you first in line for lumateperone. Just came out. Let's make you, you know, pimavanserin gets it. So let us be mindful and conscious of new things as they come along. But it would be magical thinking to put all our eggs in the basket of meds are going to save this. So at least for the time being, we've got to figure out how to help cope with this.
Joe Goldberg continues that discussion in our online interview, where he reveals strategies to help patients with treatment-resistant depression regain control over their lives. Subscribe online and you'll get $30 off with the promo code PODCAST. That's all caps.
Joseph Joe Goldberg is a clinical professor of psychiatry at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine and maintains a private practice focused on mood disorders. He has published 3 psychiatric textbooks and is completing a 4th on psychopharmacology.
Join us next week where autism expert Patricia Eves will share her practical tips for working with autism.
And thank you to all our subscribers for helping us bring you this unsponsored content free of industry support.